We've all heard about the birds and the bees, but usually that applies to the sex lives of us, humans. What about the actual sex lives of those bees and birds and the other creatures?
Our next guest says that the more we learn about our animal friends and about their lives below the belt, so to speak, the more we'll understand about evolution, biology, diversity, and the beauty of all nature's life forms.
Joining us now is Menno Skjelthusen. He's ecologist and evolutionary biologist at Naturalis Biodiversity Center in Leiden, the Netherlands. His new book is Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. Menno, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, your book, you tell a lot of fascinating stories about the sex lives of animals, insects in particular, but this isn't just for entertainment. Why are animals' sex lives and their sex organs so important to studying evolution?
Well, they're really the places where evolution seems to do its greatest tricks. If you look at insects, I mean, if you look at a number of species of a particular type of bug, to the untrained eye, and even to the trained eye, they often seem very similar externally on the outside. But once you look at the way their genitals, their reproductive organs look and function and work, you find great differences even between species that look identical on the outside. So it seems that evolution works fastest and most dramatically in those organs which have directly to do with reproduction. And since evolution is all about reproduction, that's maybe not so surprising.
It's an interesting thing that, you know, it's so important, at least we view it as that today, because for a long time, evolutionary biologists, you know, would kind of push off to the side anybody who wanted to study the genitalia of animals or the sex lives of animals. And they said it just wasn't important. It was a waste of time. What happened to bring it back into the spotlight?
Yeah, that's, well, what you say is absolutely true. It's very surprising that biologists have been studying the sex organs of plants with abandon for more than a century. That's always been completely mainstream, namely studying flowers and the way insects and birds pollinate flowers, and yet the way these genitalia function has never really taken much interest for many years. And it was really until the 1980s that a scientist called Bill Eberhardt of the Smithsonian Institution, he was the first to use all that information that was already available, because people were using these reproductive organs to recognize species and to separate species and to describe them in animals, and started really asking the question, why would all these differences exist? What kind of evolution goes on that makes these species that are so similar on the outside differ so dramatically and so drastically in their sex organs? And it really, I mean, he's really a hero of mine. It's so rare to have a biologist who can look across different subfields within biology and take information from one field and try to apply it somewhere else. And that's really what was needed to bring this kind of study into mainstream evolutionary biology.
Well, let's get into some really basic questions here. From the perspective of a biologist, what is sex, and do all members of the animal kingdom have sex?
Right. If you ask the man in the street what is sex, you get a very different answer from what you get if you ask a biologist. To a biologist, sex or sexual reproduction is a kind of reproduction in which two organisms mix their genetic material and put that mixture into an offspring. There are many ways to do that. I mean, even bacteria can have sex, because they sometimes exchange bits of DNA with other bacteria. Even though they're not animals, they don't have males and females. They don't even have sex organs. They don't insert anything into each other. They just transfer a little bit of DNA molecule, and to a biologist, that's sex. But of course, in animals and humans, sex has become almost synonymous with reproduction. So we do that exchanging of DNA while we are reproducing, but that's not necessarily the case. And there are also many other ways of reproducing without having sex. I mean, many organisms clone themselves very simply without having any exchange of DNA.
And I guess to jump off those questions, what is the point of having sex really for the animal kingdom? I mean, it seems like it would be more efficient for an animal to clone itself.
Absolutely. And on paper, it is more efficient because you don't waste time finding mates. You don't have to share your DNA with somebody else. You can make sure that all your offspring have all your DNA. You don't have to water it down with somebody else's. So it's been a very major question in biology for a long time, why there would be sex in the first place and why it is so popular in evolution to have sexual reproduction. Why doesn't everybody clone themselves? So there must be something really important because it seems to give only disadvantages and no obvious advantages. And the fun involved doesn't qualify as an advantage to biologists. So there are now two main theories, and one is that it's a way to repair errors, reading errors in the DNA. You have these mistakes made when DNA is copied, and all those mistakes are inherited by your offspring, unless you can combine your DNA with somebody else's DNA, which may not have errors in the same places where you have errors in your DNA. So by doing that and by making random combinations of all those errors, you can make sure that your offspring have a great diversity of all those errors, and the bad ones will get weeded out. That's one theory. Another theory is that, again, this variation that you create by mixing DNA with somebody else's and by making sure that all your offspring have a different combination of genes, you can outwit parasites or disease organisms. You could imagine that if you clone yourself, then if you happen to have a gene that makes you susceptible to a disease and all your offspring inherit that same susceptibility, then if this disease strikes, all your offspring will be dead. Whereas if you have genetic variation in your offspring, then some may survive and some may not survive. But at least you have a higher chance that some will survive. And the idea is that this has also been a very important reason very early in the history of life for sex to evolve.
You mentioned the concept of sex as fun earlier. We as humans have evolved to get a pleasure reward from it. Is that normal in the animal kingdom, or are we unique?
I'm sure it's normal, yeah. Of course, it's very hard for us to look into the brain of a slug or a beetle, but I'm sure there is, in all animals, there's some sort of reward system to make sure that that these animals go to the trouble of finding a mate and mating. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. Or you could turn it around and say, if there were any animals in the past in a particular species who didn't like sex, they all died out because they didn't reproduce. So I'm sure the enjoyment that we have, we share that with almost all other life forms that have sexual reproduction.
So if we're going to talk about biodiversity, you really get a sense of how broad things can evolve when you look at the genitalia of, say, insects. And you write about a lot of the bizarre sexual behaviors among insects that kind of make human bedroom behavior seem pretty boring. Can you tell us about a couple of them?
Well, it seems, our sex life seems boring because we take it as a norm, but I'm sure from an insect's perspective, ours is very bizarre. Take a bed bug, for example. Those of us who live near bed bugs know them more intimately than we'd like, but even many people who host bed bugs are not aware that these animals practice something that's called traumatic insemination, and traumatic in this sense means physically traumatic, in the sense that trauma means wound in Greek. So what these bed bugs do is the males have evolved a dagger-like penis, and even though the females have a perfectly fine vagina, this is not used during mating. Instead, the male uses this dagger-like penis to inject his sperm directly into the body of the female. And the sperm cells then swim autonomically through the tissues and through all the organs of the female to reach the ovaries. And the female uses her vagina only to lay eggs and not to receive sperm. And there are many other organisms that reproduce in the same way. That's one of the more bizarre ones.
And we'll get into some of the more of those stories in just a few moments. We've got Menno Schulthausen with us. He's author of Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tells Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves.
We're continuing our conversation about nature's nether regions, what animal sex lives can teach us about evolution and the incredible diversity of life on Earth. With us now is Menno Schulthausen, ecologist and evolutionary biologist at Naturalis Biodiversity Center in Leiden. He's the author of the new book called Nature's Nether Regions.
And Menno, earlier you mentioned the beetles who, you know, species might look very similar to one another but have drastically different genitalia. How big are the differences, and why would they evolve so differently?
Yeah. Well, there's the differences can be very big. I myself work with a family of so I do some research on a family of beetles which are called Liodidae. They're very small, brownish, grayish, round beetles that live in the soil, and here in the Netherlands, and I'm sure in many parts of the U.S. too, you can find 10, 15 species sharing the same patch of forest, and they look pretty similar on the outside. And when you then dissect out the male genitalia, the penis, you can find things that are spoon-shaped, you can find things that are fork-shaped, you can find things that are three-pronged, things that have an internal sac with very large teeth on it or no teeth at all. So the differences are pretty big. I mean, it sometimes could take you an hour to identify a species by looking at the outside characteristics, but as soon as you dissect out the penis, you can tell it within a fraction of a second which species it is.
And is this something that leads to speciation, to species splitting off from each other when they change so much that they can no longer interbreed with ones whose genitalia haven't evolved to keep up with them?
Presumably that also happens, although I would tend to think that the genitals evolve differences somewhat later, so that the speciation is set in motion because of adaptation to different habitats or different niches within the habitat, different kinds of food, and that then splits a species in two, and that then makes that any improvement, any change, any evolution in genitals will remain restricted to each of those species, and that's what causes the differences, which may make it even more unlikely that these two species will be able to crossbreed. But I'm not sure if we have any cases where new species have evolved because they evolved a different kind of genital.
Now to go back to the insects themselves, or arachnid in this case, one animal that seems like we know a fair bit about in terms of their sex life is the spider. And there are, of course, stories about the female spider. I think it's the black widow, but different spiders, the female eating the male after intercourse. How much of that is true? What do we know about spiders?
Yeah, that's quite true in general, especially with black widow spiders and other kinds of spiders, where the male is much smaller than the female. In most spiders, these females are huge, and the males are tiny. And in those species, it's very common for the male to end up as the female's lunch immediately after mating. And because they have such a poor life expectancy after coitus, you see all very drastic measures evolving in these males, sort of self-sacrificial measures to ensure that the sperm they have delivered to the female is actually going to be used by her to fertilize her eggs. For example, there are many spiders, including those black widows, where the male's genitals actually break off after mating, and they remain stuck in her vagina, actually in her vaginas, because she has two, and the male also has two penises on either side of the head, if you can still believe me. And that then plugs the vagina and makes it more difficult for a subsequent male to also insert his penises. So that might actually mean that despite being eaten, such a second male doesn't even get to fertilize the female.
You know, one of the driving forces between these really unique adaptations seems to be, in a lot of species, a battle between the sexes. The male and the female have different interests when it comes to reproducing and evolution. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, that's really what seems to be behind much of this very drastic evolution, the fact that there's a sort of a conflict of interest between males and females in many species. You could imagine that for any male that mates with a female, what would serve his interest best would be if this particular male would use this particular female would use this particular male sperm to fertilize all her eggs with. That would be great from the viewpoint of the male, but for the female, it's often much more beneficial to not to put all her eggs in one basket, as it were, to have multiple males fertilizing some of her eggs and to pick and choose. So you see that a lot of this evolution in the genitalia is centered around this conflict of interest, that certain features of the male genitalia try to ensure that the female uses his sperm to fertilize a lot of her eggs. For example, a lot of males have spines on their penises, which they can use to actually inject substances in the female, which mess with her psychology to make her go off males for a few days after mating, so that at least during that time, he doesn't have to fear any competition from other males. And in females, on the other hand, you often see that there are special pockets, different pockets in which you can store sperm of different males and then use these at will at a later stage.
Wow.
To fertilize her eggs with. For example, a queen ant gets fertilized only during her bridal flight at the beginning of her life, and then she rules the colony sometimes for decades using all that time, using sperm that she stored all those years back from multiple males, and basically deciding for each new egg she lays which male's sperm is going to be used to fertilize those eggs. And so you always have this conflict of interest, and that's probably what drives this enormously fast evolution.
Well, it's interesting, you know, thinking about that. You said earlier that you imagine that there was some sort of pleasure response for animals, and that was probably, you know, partially why they do it, the biological imperative, all of that. But, you know, when you look at these examples, it doesn't seem like much fun. There's a lot of biting and and
stabbing
death and stabbing.
Yeah.
Right. So where does the fun part come in for animals?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't know how these animals feel when they're doing these vicious kinds of reproductive behavior. But there's also a lot of sweetness going on. There's also a lot of stroking and persuasion, very gentle persuasion going on. A lot of insects have so-called paramires, which are little brushes on the side of their penis. So while they're mating, they're using these to titillate or to brush the female's abdomen. And you can sometimes even see that a female would use one of her hind legs to move those paramires, those little brush-like organs, a little bit to the side, as if she wants to put them in a place that's slightly more pleasurable. So it's not all aggression. There's all kinds of things going on, and how these animals actually feel about that, unfortunately, we have no way of knowing.
One that caught my attention, the male burrowing barnacle seems to be a species that's gone to an extreme. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's quite interesting. The male burrowing barnacle is still slated as the animal in the animal kingdom that has the longest penis relative to its size. It's about 10 times as long as the animal is wide. And that was actually discovered by Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin studied for 8 years. He studied barnacles. He didn't, when he came back from his voyage on the Beagle, he didn't pen down his earth-shattering theory. He studied barnacles for many years. And this is one of the species he described. And he also described this enormously long penis, which has survived as a record holder since then. And, of course, the reason is that barnacles live fixed to rocks, and they cannot themselves go look for partners, so they have to send their penis on a prowl around the barnacle colony to find mates.
And in terms of the animals you studied, and they're also, I mean, all of these examples are sort of so mind-bending from a human perspective, but what's one that really sort of surprised even you?
Well, that's one that's surprisingly not in my book. That was published just a few weeks ago. You may have heard of it. There was a cave louse in Brazil discovered, which sort of seems to have a reversal, where the females have a penis which they use to penetrate the male and to grab his sperm package, which is very nutritious and very valuable for the female, and take it from him in a sort of reversal of sex roles. And I was really disappointed that I didn't know about this particular example before I finished the book, because it would have fitted perfectly, because it shows that in the sexual evolution, it's not really about being male or being female, but it's about who contributes most energy or most resources to the offspring. And in this case, this was the male, and that's what produces this reversal of roles and organs in this particular species.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Menno, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
That was Menno Schildhausen, ecologist and evolutionary biologist at Naturalis Biodiversity Center in Leiden in the Netherlands. He's the author of Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Bees Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves.